When you just really, really want to see Ibra take a penalty, so you give him one. It's That's So MLS. With myself, Nick Thornton. With me, as always, is Andrew Bates. Andrew, how are you this week?
I'm doing great. Ibra's doing great.
Ibra's doing ever so well.
I love that. And this isn't about this game specifically, but on the MLS YouTube channel, the pinned video, if you go there, for almost all the whole season has been Zlatan's first goal until he scored that 500th goal against Vancouver, and now that's the new pinned video. So if you're
shameless.
an MLS team and you want to get some good promotion, get scored on by Zlatan and MLS will promote you forever.
True indeed. We should mention that we are a weekly North American soccer podcast available on iTunes and wherever fine podcasts are procured.
Yes. Please review and subscribe.
Please do those things. A pretty busy week of games and some interesting developments. Where do you want to begin with this batch?
I thought it was funny to me that... It seems like nothing. Like there were a couple of close games, but I'm amused at the propensity at this time of the year for matches to be complete blowouts. Like, and it's not necessarily the same team having a blowout every, like, you know, conceding a blowout every week. It just seems that sometimes teams are out to really make their mark. You got a chance to see Montreal 3, Columbus nothing. I didn't, but that is an emphatic result for Montreal as they make their playoff push.
Absolutely, and I think a big statement, I think a number of people, including myself, went into watching this match, thinking that this could be sort of a 0-0, 1-1 affair. Both teams are set up pretty similarly. Columbus is quite defensive. Montreal is also quite defensive. Certainly, Columbus has the better defensive record. But Columbus really just seemed to be kind of off of it, and there really wasn't much going for them. Very few chances were created. In the 32nd minute, a very clear penalty is called. Taider takes it calmly. Silva has a fantastic goal. Piatti sort of finishes them off. But like looking back at this game, there really wasn't much in it for Columbus, and I would say an uncharacteristically defensively poor game from them. But as we've seen, Montreal, when they're doing well, they've just got so much speed up front, it becomes really difficult to deal with, and Zach Steffen got caught out a number of times just being the last man back, and Columbus's shape just being all over the place. So it's disappointing for Columbus, but you know, they're still ahead by 5 points in the Eastern Conference. But a big, big statement from Montreal, who are just 2 points ahead of DC United and being chased by them. So great for Montreal, but you have to feel like they do need to win the rest of their games now with DC United nipping at their heels.
Absolutely. What I found interesting, especially given that, is that Columbus had... You know, a slight lead in shots, 13-14. Both sides had 9 on target. And Columbus had 55% of possession. And some of the only periods where Montreal had a lot of possession were the ones that they scored in. Do you think that Columbus just wasn't able to get stuff together when they had that possession?
Yeah, I think it's a number of things, and this is sort of what's plagued them all season long, is defensively they're set up quite well and can get the job done, but they have the fewest goals scored in the Eastern Conference with just 39, and that's been the thing that's plagued them. And a team like Montreal doesn't need an invitation to score. So for me, it's about Columbus finding a way to get on the score sheet and then defend that lead rather than ending up sort of slowly growing into a game and doing overall quite well. As you said, the possession is good. The production rate hasn't been. But no matter how good your defense is or how good your goalkeeper is, if you're having to spend the majority of the match on the back foot eventually somebody's going to break you down. And I think we've seen that's kind of where Columbus's weakness is, that if they had a little bit more firepower going forward and they could be protecting a lead as opposed to just protecting a clean sheet, then they might be in a little bit better of a position.
That makes sense. The position in the standings now, they sit in fifth, 5 points ahead of Montreal in the last playoff spot. They are now the last two teams fighting for their position in trying to evade DC, as Philadelphia also had a very emphatic result. I believe that was 5-1 against Minnesota.
I believe so, yeah. Let me just get back up to the top. Yes, or where are you, Philadelphia? Yeah, 5-1 against Philadelphia, or Minnesota. Goodness me, can tell we're jumping into this after a long day. Who played? Did you get to see this match?
No. I didn't get the chance to see it. As you know, I often compare Philadelphia and Minnesota. So this was a flattening from a team that needed to, I think, gain a little bit of momentum heading into the playoffs.
Absolutely. And momentum has been in Philadelphia's corner, obviously missing out on the U.S. Open Cup or Lamar Hunter or whatever the thing. It's Open Cup right now, right?
The U.S. Open Cup.
That's what
Cup,
we're calling yes. it this year. That was a disappointment, but they've really bounced back from it. And I believe this game clinched their playoff spot, if I'm not. Yeah, it did. So now they've got a fourth playoff spot. And it kind of starts early. And if you look at the timestamps on the goals, it really just kind of was all Philadelphia all night long. Certainly in the first half. I mean, four goals in the first half. Corey Burke gets another. Bedoya adds on to it. Fafa Pico had two incredible goals back-to-back. Quintero, as he has often had to do so many times, decides to lift the team on his back and just try to get something out of the match.
Oh, yeah.
And has a really tasty little goal. But, you know, you feel so bad for a player like that who can't even really celebrate, because even at 54 minutes, 4-1, you kind of know the inevitable is on its way. And we're getting to it a little bit early, I think, and I may go back on this later, but Ilsinho's goal in the 79th minute, if you look that one up, that's my goal of the week. It's just a beauty, long-range effort. Bobby Shuttleworth, I know that he's a good goalkeeper, but this has just been such a poor, poor season from him, and I know he's not had a lot of help from his defenders. But I felt like three of these goals at least should have been easy saves, and he just guessed the wrong way or was very, very late in getting down. And I think that had he been a little bit more in form, then perhaps maybe they still would have lost, but they wouldn't be in the position they're in. It's disappointing, too, because Minnesota showed flashes of brilliance as they did last season as well. But it really is hard to imagine not just blowing the team up in the offseason.
I don't know about that, just because when you look at them when they're firing well, the team has a good, you know, composition. People are the energy around it is very good. So I don't know if this is like the break it up moment. I kind of see them a little bit more in the spot that we saw, you know, a New England Revolution last year, where clearly isn't their year, but I do think that they have something to put together.
Yeah, I think that they've got close to the right idea, but, you know, the teams that are leaking the most goals in the West, there's a number of them. Just, it's incredible to think that there's five teams in the West that have given up more than 60 goals, or 60-plus goals.
Wow.
LA Galaxy, Vancouver Whitecaps, Minnesota, Colorado, and San Jose. And that's just not good enough. Those are real bad numbers. It's MLS. You're going to get scored against. I mean, for perspective, even Atlanta's given up 40 goals. So, you know.
It happens.
It happens. But it's just such... It's concerning to see teams like this that you know, when it goes wrong, it goes catastrophically wrong. And I don't think that it's just down to team identity or coaching. I think that there needs to be a little bit more grit and talent from the back lines in these teams.
Yeah.
And especially in midfield, Minnesota just looks really, really quite weak, and it's easy to run through them and get into space, despite the obvious talent that they have on their team. But at this point, I think some questions need to be asked of Bobby Shuttleworth, who, and I get it, it's thankless when you don't have the support in front of you. But again, at least two or three of those should have been easy saves for him, and sort of dug them into this hole.
It's interesting that they ship so many goals in the West, but Western teams have had a little bit of an advantage in interconference play so far this year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I gotta run the numbers on what that actually amounts to, but it always seems each week that there's only, you know, maybe one Eastern team that comes close. I did get to see that Il Senio goal. Wow.
Pretty tasty, right? It's kind of goal you dream about scoring.
He just sort of collects the ball and is able to, you know, I think it looks like a little bit of a transition moment, but he hits. It's one of those goals where you can tell they just have the idea. They don't need any time to think about what they're going to do with it. It's a beautiful long range rising and falling ball that hits the back of the net.
I think that's why Philadelphia's done so well this season, is that they have that creativity. They don't have the star power on their team that other teams have, but they've been steadily grinding out victories on the fact that they've got four or five goal scorers that, you know, it's been a while now since CJ Sapong got a goal, or maybe he got one last week, but his production rate has dipped a little bit. Mm-hmm. But when you've got the likes of Corey Burke that can step in and crack things home, that's what it takes. So they're certainly still in it with a shake, and now that they've clinched their playoff spot, I'm really interested to see the Eastern Conference playoffs. And as much as things are still kind of up in the air in the West, I'm beginning to think this is going to be a pretty exciting playoff season, because right now in the East, out of the four teams that have clinched, Atlanta, both New York's and Philadelphia, any one of those four teams could beat the other three on, depending on the day. So I'm very curious and excited to see how things line up and what those knockout rounds look like.
And the four teams that are still in contention, Columbus, Montreal, DC, and New England, although New England are not the best shout of the four, are kind of like shit disturber teams, where it's like any of the four that you mentioned can beat the other four. And mm-hmm. maybe you wouldn't necessarily say that of Columbus or the Impact. But Columbus, the Impact of DC could really cause a problem for any of the other teams in the conference.
Yeah, I totally agree. And that can happen as well. I'd never underestimate the team that's ready to play heartbreaker at this point in the season. And even if they don't quite make it in, I feel like that's going to be DC's role in a big way. If they don't make that playoff spot, boy, are they going to cause some problems for those trying to, for New England and Montreal.
Yeah, absolutely. The DC had a great result on Sunday. I was very excited because everything had looked after this big, great result for Montreal. Everything had sort of, you know, they really needed Chicago, who is not in contention, to give them mm-hmm. a result. And then Raheem Edwards scores, which on Twitter I referred to as his third goal for the Montreal Impact in the season.
And great for the kid. We're big Raheem Edwards fans, as folks listening know, and it's great to see him finally getting something for Chicago and creating a little bit for them. And also showing that what a great signing he's been for Chicago. And that's what Chicago needs more of, is just a little bit of flash of youth and creativity to get them going.
But it was a Wayne Rooney double that sealed their fate. It was kind of this scenario where, you know, I guess, you know, when a team is firing as heavily as DC is, and Chicago doesn't have the stake in it, Montreal could sit there and think, please, please, please. But not only is it challenging to find a way to overcome DC when they have that momentum, but like there may be no motivation to do so.
Yeah.
You're away from home.
Go ahead.
You're away from home. You're barely holding on, and maybe it's hard to muster up that fight this late in the season.
Yeah. And I imagine Chicago at this point, yeah, people are playing for positions and just seeing what they can do for next year, which does make them a difficult team to play against. So credit to DC for getting the job done, because a wounded cat backed into a corner is very dangerous, and it's not like Chicago lacks the ability to score goals. It's almost sort of incredible to think about with the, you know, you've got Alexander Katai, you've got Nikolic, you've got Schweinsteiger, you've got McCarty, that they haven't been able to put together results and are eliminated is just sort of baffling. But, when we saw the quick-footedness of Raheem Edwards, that certainly looks good for them. But Rooney could have actually had three in this game, except his first goal was called off. But I'm just going to fully go ahead and admit it. I think I might be a Wayne Rooney fan now.
Has he won you over?
I think he has.
You had these great posts about the 50th, about our 50th episode last week, and how we've become so much bigger fans of the league. We've enjoyed the league, and we've all picked up teams that are near and dear to our hearts. And DC was on that list for you.
Yeah, and it's not just because of Rooney, and it's not just because of David Ofsted as well. It's because seeing a team that, you know, struggled so early in the season, a team that's kind of been off of people's radars for the last couple of years, but is as much of a classic MLS entity as you can imagine, that's kind of going through this reinvention or reinvigoration of themselves without losing their identity. And, I mean, who doesn't love a good comeback story where it's not just one star player coming in? It's, the likes of Areola, Yamil Assad, a number of players that have been really crucial. Their midfield is fantastic too. Their defensive mids have been great and often overlooked this season. So I think what it really comes down to is, as I was talking about in this series of tweets, is the more games you watch, the more you start to enjoy the league. And DC United for me is one of the teams now where I'm actually looking to see when their games are on so I can watch them, because I just enjoy watching them play. Win or lose, they're just such an interesting team right now. And I just think the creativity that they have is so much more interesting than most MLS clubs.
Absolutely. I think that seeing you made a great point that there have been a lot of acquisitions and a lot of squad building. And in the importance of a revitalization like that is unfortunately what we've seen in the Columbus situation is that if a team is in an organizational doldrums for too long and loses its connection to its audience, it might, like, no, this is not, of course, not to blame anything on the Columbus fans, but like, but there's no loyalty from the league's end that, like, this is a famous franchise in the history of the league. It has to stay around.
Yeah.
So the revitalization viewed with the continuous issues that Columbus has had, hashtag save the crew, is alongside that is this idea that, you know, a revitalization like this heads off a potential issue of this type down the road.
Yeah, and I mean, I don't want to get too in-depth into MLS politics and business that I frankly don't really understand, but I think it's a good bit of business from the DC front office to get the stadium done, to get Rooney in. But not just bring in a star, but bring in the right kind of star that's really going to help bolster the team. And as we've seen numerous times, a player that actually works for the team as well. He hasn't come in and made it about him. He's come in and quietly put in the work and gotten bums in seats and got them out of seats when he's sort of taking the team on his back. For me, the next step for DC is to really prove that they can do it without Rooney, because he won't be there forever. Yeah. He is an older player. All it takes is one knock and he's down. I think luckily, he's been a player that's been pretty injury-free through most of his career, knock on wood. And I think that DC can do it without him, but this was one really where they needed him to show up, and that's happened in a number of times now, and he has shown up. So for me, that's everything you want in your marquee DP signing, is not just showing up and scoring a goal, but is being that difference maker, which I think it's very, very clear he is.
It's right to say that he has been mostly injury-free, although I did want to include the little tidbit that that he is the reason why I know what a metatarsal is after fracturing his metatarsal in advance of the, I think, the 2006 or 2010 World Cup or whichever it was.
Right, yes.
Having to be like, okay, what is a metatarsal? Now anytime anybody mentions it, I know what it is because Rooney broke his that one time. This result puts DC in a really power position, unfortunately, for the Impact to have such a great result. They now need Columbus to lose. The only way they can overtake Columbus is if Columbus loses both of its remaining games.
Who are they playing?
That would be Orlando away and Minnesota at home. So
okay, well, that bodes well.
That bodes well for, well, that bodes well for Columbus.
For Columbus. It doesn't bode well for Montreal.
No. And DC have two games in hand because they are at this juncture the beneficiaries of a strange season that his a strange scheduling because of Audi Field's construction that has front-loaded the season with away games, and they were one win, nine losses, in two draws away, and loaded the back of the season with home games when they are 10-2-2.
Yeah, their home record is absolutely bonkers. That being said, they don't have an easy job of it. They've got three home games coming up, but I think they're going to be three very highly contested matches, and they're all happening within a week. So that's the other thing to consider, is that Saturday they're playing Dallas, and then Wednesday they're playing Toronto, and then the following Sunday they're playing New York City. So three difficult games. We saw Toronto get eliminated this weekend, but again, Toronto's going to be playing for Pride. That's not going to be an easy match at all. Dallas has been really difficult. New York City FC, of course. So I feel like if DC can get points out of those three games, then they absolutely deserve that final spot. But they are going to have to work for it right up until the final. And we might joke about Chicago's fortunes, but that's their last game of the season. It's away. Chicago's got nothing to lose. They're going to be in experimental form, I'm sure, playing players that maybe DC's not played against before. So I don't think anything is for certain for DC. They're doing themselves a lot of favors by getting the results they are, but they are going to have a really tough run of games, even with the games in hand.
The last two games for Montreal are home to Toronto and away to New England. New England have proven themselves a little beatable. That's going to be a knockdown, rip-roaring game between Montreal and Toronto. Even if Toronto is eliminated, there's so much pride on the line there, too.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Do we want to jump to Toronto, or I was going to go to Atlanta, but I'm...
Let's go to Toronto now.
Let's take a little trip to Toronto.
We were talking, you said, and I kind of agreed with you, that you didn't see a way for Vancouver, maybe, that they might not win another game this season, and they went ahead and won the next game.
They sure did, and boy, have I been proven wrong many, many times on this show, and never have I been so delighted by it as this last week. I forgot. We have a secret weapon who has not been able to play much in the forward positions in the last 5 years, but Russell Tybert in the fourth minute gets one for the good guys.
Oh, yeah.
And immediately you start to think like, oh, wait, hang on a second. Toronto probably wasn't expecting that. And for the next 50 or so minutes really did look out of sorts. Like, wait, what? Vancouver scored first, but we're at home.
Listen, you don't get it. We score a bunch and you don't.
Yeah.
Or
yeah.
some. We score 5 goals. Then Toronto is just like, as Toronto is getting scored on, they're like, guys, remember, we're supposed to score 5 goals here.
Mm-hmm.
As the Canadian Championship second leg would have it. It was a great reversal of fortune from that.
It was, I mean, as always, Vancouver made it difficult for themselves. Daniil Henry just handled I don't know what he was doing sliding in on the Jay Chapman cross, just had his arms way up like he saw someone in the crowd he recognized and was trying to get their attention, and just gives up a really silly penalty, and which Altidore is going to knock home all day long. And then it was sort of like, okay, game is on here. And I think for a lot of Vancouver fans, that's when we started to feel like, oh, this is where it shifts. Because it wasn't a very good second half from Vancouver. Toronto had lots of balls in the box, but Giovinco and Altidore just could not finish on the night. And that really saved Vancouver some blushes. And then Jordan Mutch comes in, finds space down the wing, and just picks out Kai Kamara, who, as always, just seems to be in the right place.
Yeah.
And it's such a testament to, if you can get service to Kamara, then he can stay between the two center backs and be of a real threat. But if you're asking him to come back and do a ton of defensive work, which he's great at doing, then you're not going to get those same chances. So I feel like Dalrymple's done a good job of keeping Kai Kamara up top in that position for a whole 90 minutes, but really switching out the personnel and being very clear about, like, look, Kai Kamara can put it away. He'll get the goal, but you need to get him the service to do it.
Kamara has seemed really, in this second half of the season, really reliable in the sense that, like, you know, he doesn't score every single game, but if you can get him that ball in that position, he'll usually bury it.
Yeah, and he's a versatile striker as well. I mean, I don't want to read too much into it because I probably watch too many Instagram stories from Whitecaps players, but it also, I think Kai Kamara's happy wherever he goes for the most part, except maybe Columbus towards the end.
Right.
But it's clear that he really does love the game. And, you know, I'm watching some stories of, like, him with the team, with Alphonso Davies, recently this week, just back in Vancouver, running along Kitts Beach with his dog, loving the rain, loving the city of Vancouver. Despite how difficult things have been, Kai Kamara hasn't lost faith in the team, and I think has been the voice of leadership that we've really needed. But the leadership is being provided by the example that he sets.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm sure, regardless of what happens in the offseason, I'd love to do should they stay or should they go with you and decide which caps we'd keep and which ones we'd kick. But I think at this point it's pretty hard to argue. Like, we want Kai Kamara back next year. He fits the mold. He's got the right mentality, and regardless of where we've been in the season, he's been positive on and off the pitch. And that's the kind of thing that it's easy to overlook, but has clearly become something really critical for the team, is the other players believe in him as well.
I think that, you know, it's always important when you look at the club's MLS history to remember that, you know, seven years is not that many years, and there were some lean years in there. But in a really sneaky way, this is 14th goal on the season. He now sits sixth in the all-time Whitecap scoring in MLS. This is true of a lot of, you know, I'd say this was also true of Toronto, where outside of their big top scoring players, you see it very easy to sort of, you know, get pretty high up the list in one season.
Mm-hmm.
But it really has been a remarkable performance this year.
It has been, and I know it's unpopular to, and I want Vancouver to spend more money on players too, but this idea that, you know, we should just completely change up everything that we're doing and, you know, spend a ton of money on DPs, I think that Kai Kamara is a perfect example of a good signing of a player who fits the mold really well. He's now tied for goals with Freddie Montero. So if Freddie Montero was a star loanee or a star signing, if you want to call it that, Kai Kamara's already equaled that, and I think that has been a really good signing for us. So I don't think it's all about just going out and getting a player who's going to score a boatload of goals. 14 is a great number for the season, and I think that he's proven that, again, he fits well within the system, and he's the kind of player that you can build a team around. I think there's definitely question marks around some of the players on the wings and what we do without Alphonso Davies, but Kai Kamara feels like a piece you can count on to be back next year that we can build an attack around.
Absolutely. I like that Freddie Montero kind of will exist if Kamara does stick around and score some more goals. It's kind of like the single season benchmark. Like if you can beat, for future Whitecaps, it's like if you want to be like a Whitecaps, like known as a notable Whitecaps player, it's like you have to like hit this level as a goal scorer.
Well, I think sometimes what people forget is when they talk about teams spending more money is they don't actually look at the money that the team has already spent. And it's not, the Whitecaps have not lacked spending money. But as we've talked about before, a lot of the money that they've spent ends up sitting on the bench because they weren't the right fit for the team or their production rate has gone down. They have spent considerable money on players and considerable money on salaries. Not maybe as much as other teams, but as we've seen, that doesn't always matter.
And speaking of a team where that doesn't always matter, this was the end of Toronto's chances. They will not be defending the MLS Cup in the playoffs. They will not be hosting the MLS Cup final for the third consecutive year. This is not a surprise. I think people...
It was a surprise to me that I got something right for once.
Well,
every week for the last 7 weeks going, it's not going to happen. They're out. Why do people keep saying they can do it? They can't.
And then everybody agreed with you, and then they won that game, and everybody was like, but what if it happens?
Including me.
I'm not immune by any sense of the word. Obviously a big disappointment for what they attempted to achieve. Do you think that they just sort of were overrun by injuries? Do you think that the loss to Chivas in the Champions League final, like once kind of like a corollary to Ronda Rousey in MMA, where it's like the unstoppable team once becomes stopped, it's like now we reset. Was it psychological? Was it just circumstance? What happened?
I think it's a bit of all of those things. Greg Vanney's a great coach, and I don't want to make it sound simple because I'm sure we can all comfortably say from our couches and chairs what we would have done differently, and certainly you and I have. Mm-hmm. But it's clear that he has a plan for the team and has tried different things. But we saw it last year too, that he tried different combinations of plays and formations, and it didn't always work out for them. I honestly think some of it just comes down to this. It's MLS. Every year is different. Every team is competitive to a certain point. And Toronto got really lucky last year a few times. Now, they won that cup fair and square. That was not luck. That was hard work and a team that really played for each other. But I think Toronto was missing a few key pieces this year in terms of a bit of holding mid support. And then, of course, with all of the backline injuries that they had. This is why teams need to carry five center backs, as Carl Robinson, RIP, always pointed out. And they sold one of the best right backs in the league to LAFC, who's everywhere Steven Betisher has gone, he's been a fantastic defensive presence and providing presence for his team. And I just can't fathom why he moves around so much, even as an older player.
Gregory Vanderveel gets sent off here, and I don't think Vanderveel has had an awful season. At times, he's been the best defender on the Toronto backline by dint of the fact that all the better defenders are injured.
Yeah.
But it's a symbolic gesture in what I'm curious what you think of his mark on the team having been this year and coming in as the sort of default. I think he was in the same position, so the default replacement for Betisher how he's performed.
I think overall he's had an okay season. I think we can call it that fairly. Yeah. I guess I have trouble sometimes understanding the theory behind getting rid of a player that's in his 30s for a player that's 30. That, okay, so he's an international, but it really seemed like you could have just kept Betasher for more or less the same amount of money and had a player that understood and organized really well and then ship him off and then have to bring in a replacement. I don't think the right back position is completely essential, but just for a league where good left and right backs are in such short supply, when you have a good one, for God's sakes, hang on to it.
Yeah,
and I think any team that can hold on to Stephen Betasher for more than a season really would be doing themselves a good deal of business and quality. I think that for Toronto, it also comes down to they always thought they were a better team than they were, and I don't want to take away from how good they were last year, but again, they did have some very lucky stretches, and they also heavily relied on two players to really keep them in things, and those two players have been out of form, have been injured this year, have at various points stepped up and really helped. The question I have about Toronto now is, looking to the offseason, what do you do with them? Because it's not a system you need to or want to blow up. Certainly, but I think there's big changes that need to happen. And, you know, we talked about even at the end of last year, it wasn't certain that Altidore and Giovinco would be back. And who knows, they may well be, but what does that post Altidore era look like for Toronto? Because Giovinco, we've seen, you know, he'll have his moments of brilliance, but you can't just carry a whole team with him.
Well, Janssen, Lucas Janssen, I did this last week too. Lucas Janssen has been such a great acquisition. I don't know that he's on loan, so you can't count on him forever. I don't know that he's the one loan solution, but he has been a great help, and I think that in terms of what can we do to improve this team, that's a big move that they've already made in August to bring him in. He's had an immediate impact. Mm-hmm. I think there is a magic that exists with this team as currently constituted. The problem is that it is with a very specific lineup, and that's having Vasquez, Giovinco, and Altidore.
Yes, I think they could potentially have one of the best starting lineups in MLS. They just haven't had that starting 11 together for more than three or four matches this season.
As you've put it, they've had opportunities to experiment, and especially in that first part of the season where they got real wild and gave people some real experience. It wasn't really promising.
No.
What did come about with it? So you have to say that there must be depth, because those three players are not going to, you're not necessarily going to hold on to them forever. As you could tell this year, they're not going to be healthy forever.
I think for me, for Toronto, it really is just a case about building some more depth, you know, bring in, I think, some midfield help to help support Bradley in the defensive duties and maybe sign four, five, or six center backs in the offseason and hold them. But if they can hang on to the players that they have for the most part, the key players anyway, we know what Vasquez can do. We know what Giovinco and Altidore can do. So it could work really well. The wild card is always that, yes, they're really good, but as we've seen this year, other teams have made changes and made acquisitions that have just been better. So even without the misfortune, I still think Toronto would be struggling. Maybe not as badly as they have been, but every team improves. Maybe not Colorado, but every team improves year after year. And it's highly competitive, and if you're going to rest on your laurels, even when the system works and you've won MLS Cup, I think that's extremely naive. Toronto didn't need to make a lot of changes, but they could have shored up and added some depth, which I don't feel like they did until it was kind of too late.
I think that one of the keys, because of how successful it's been, is to not just get depth, because, you know, there was lots of depth that already happened. But like they have got players that they brought in to be in those positions. I think that they need to make system changes that allows them to keep that magic alive, but be able to swap players in and out.
Yeah.
Finding more players, and I don't know if they have the money to bring in a player that is equal to a Vasquez to be a backup to a Vasquez that you could just swap in there. The salary cap may prevent that, but finding a way to create a system where you don't have to, you can keep something of the momentum and the verve of sort of TFC at its peak without those three players having to be there. And that's more than just an individual, but I do think it's more than just an individual, like, personnel issue.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I'd argue that you maybe don't need both Giovinco and Altidor at the ages they're at. I feel like freeing up one of those spots could really add some depth to the squad and some creativity that's much needed. And I know that sounds ridiculous because of the quality that both players have. But again, looking at what other teams add in the offseason, how competitive it is, I think Toronto needs to make some tough choices about how they spend that money next year.
Toronto's hopes were brought to an end. But the strange thing that happened, because of how it all came about and because of a result that happened elsewhere in the table, the Whitecaps sort of got a little bit of a lift. They're still not in a great position, sitting eighth, two spots out. Galaxy is ahead of them by 2 points, but they're only 3 points away from RSL, and they have a game in hand. So people are thinking this great away result may have people have their ears perked up with the thought that if the Whitecaps could just win the last three games, they're in.
It's not impossible. It's highly, highly unlikely, but it could happen. But I hope that this game really does remind them that, you know, to have some fun with it and to play for each other. And at this point, they've got nothing left to lose. That being said, they've got three really, really difficult games coming up. And they really do need to win each one of them. So they're home next Wednesday against Sporting Kansas City. So I believe some international call-ups are happening actually over the weekend. They may have some key players back for that game.
Mm-hmm.
But that's going to be a really, really tough match. And part of the reason why it's going to be so difficult is because aside from the gifted penalty to LA, Sporting Kansas City ground out a point to stay in it. And they've been quite shaky as of late and a little up and down, but I do think they're a step away from just calling themselves Sporting Johnny Russell. Because when you think about players that can dribble through five defenders, Johnny Russell isn't necessarily the name that comes to mind, but he single-handedly basically won them a point in that match. And, you know, knowing the blowout that they gave to us earlier in the season, Vancouver, this is going to be, it's going to say a lot about both teams. It'll say a lot about Sporting KC if they can win it to show that they can bend but not break. And they still have a chance at claiming first spot in the West. But they can be such a threatening team. The goal drought seems kind of promising, that aside from Johnny Russell, there really hasn't been much going forward for them, and a lot of misses, and looking kind of shaky at the back as well. For a back line that did so well earlier in the season, now I feel like over the last month or so, it has really, really dipped.
Mm-hmm. The you mean the production on the back line? Just repeat that.
So yeah, I mean, defensively, they've not been as sharp as they have been earlier in the season. They were sort of bulletproof, and now they seem to be springing leaks. But again, in this game, even if it's a fair penalty, LA didn't really have much else to say in this game, and having somebody like Tim Melia in the back is always going to help you out.
Absolutely. I didn't get to see the highlights of this one, but the thing that I note the most, and I think that maybe this is a big part of both the challenge and the joy that Sporting Kansas City face, is that they had about 60%, they have 59% possession, and they had a whopping 34 shot attempts with 9 shots on goal. That's crazy. 34-8, 9-3. It's kind of this in you know, anytime, even if it's been difficult defensively, anytime that you can hold LA to no shots from open play, that's a great, no goals from open play and 3 shots on target. That's pretty good. It seems to a certain degree like perhaps they did that through possession and through the best defense is a good offense kind of deal.
Yeah.
The hilarious fact of that 34 shot statistic is that a full 15 of those shots, those shot attempts came from Diego Rubio and Johnny Russell. Rubio with 9, Russell with 6. So those two people between them had more shot attempts than most MLS teams have.
Yeah.
Or shots. I don't know what you call a shot off target, but
it's a shot's a shot, right? You know, yeah. You miss 100% of the shots you don't take.
So yeah, they got 15 shots just between the two of them.
Yeah, and I think that for Sporting Kansas City, it's really just a case of getting some of them to go in. But as high up in the table as they are in second place, and as good as they've been defensively, I gotta say I don't like their chances in the playoffs. Looking at the other teams, I think that they can. I mean, they're probably going to win themselves a bye, but they're defensively a difficult team. But if they can't start producing more up front and more consistently, I got to favor a lot of the other Western teams to be able to, you know, do some damage with them over a 2-leg stretch. But maybe they'll prove me wrong. But right now, looking at any of the 4 Eastern teams that have clinched, I'm finding it hard to believe Sporting Kansas City could beat Atlanta, either New York or Philadelphia over 2 legs.
I would give them a little bit better of a shot. I think that a result like this could show that they might be able to focus a little bit more on a team that is kind of predictable in their approach attacking wise.
Yeah.
So I was going to say, oh, they could beat Philadelphia, but I would almost like put them as more likely to beat New York City than Philadelphia, because New York City is easy to shut. New York City is potent, but in some cases easy to shut down.
Yeah, I think I'd agree with that.
As people say, people marvel at teams in MLS that make the playoffs in 6th. And go on to win or make deep playoff pushes. But the fact is that MLS is such an interesting league in the way that it's constituted that we're saying this, I don't know if they could beat anything thing out of a team that's currently sitting 2nd in the West. Yeah. And it was the same thing for Vancouver last year as well. The league table benefits a team that is able to grind out consistent results. But because of the league's focus on attacking players, teams that aren't necessarily that can't necessarily take a benefit from that are able to be competitive 1-on-1.
Yeah, no, and case in point, Seattle. You know, tied for second fewest goals conceded in the league, and a team that. We talked all about how they couldn't score goals at one point in the season, and now all we can talk about is all the number of goals they can score. But the reason why they can do that is because they've got this incredible defensive record that has just steadily given them ties here and there, and maybe they've not always been the most exciting matches, but now here they are sitting in a comfortable position. And, you know, a 4-1 result against Houston, a team that we've talked about as needing to do something, and who knows from week to week if Houston is going to show up and be good or not.
But outside of... I was so excited about Houston last week, and I'm like, oh, they don't deserve to be where they are. And then they had the complete opposite result this week.
The only note I really have for this game, which ended 4-1 for Seattle, was that Will Bruin's goal in the 18th minute kind of tells you everything you need to know about this match, which is just that, again, Houston's defense is just so slow and just standing around and giving so much space and time to players that, I mean, Will Bruin has 10 full minutes, I believe, to complete that turn from his back to goal to get the ball, to place it, to put it in the net.
Oh, yeah.
That you can't do that in MLS and be expecting much out of it. No. And it's no surprise that Houston's been eliminated. I imagine they may get a few more points from their season and maybe play the spoiler for someone. But yeah, just a really poor effort from them. They looked okay for the up until that goal. Houston looked like maybe they might have something in it. But this was all Seattle all night long.
They couldn't get Minotas, who had had Mauro Minotas, who had such a great season week last week, really to have anything of value. They were able to get one sort of consolation goal late on from DeMarcus Beasley, played in by a little cheeky pass, but not a lot in it for them.
No, indeed not. Another blowout, similar fashion, same scoreline for their Cascadia rivals. Portland blows out RSL, same scoreline, 4-1.
Which is a great result, which was the great result for Vancouver that kind of puts things a little bit possibly in reach, but continues Portland's attempt to solidify their own grip on a playoff spot.
Yeah, absolutely. And really great performance from Portland. I thought things might have looked a little differently from them because Savarino gets a goal in the 55th minute and you start to go, oh, okay. There could be something on here. And then Sebastian Blanco just does what he wants when he wants, it seems. And again, defensively, RSL just completely loses their shape. They're not tracking runs at all. They're all over the place. And I think this is actually a pretty fair result, and I think RSL was a little lucky to not be hammered out of it more, but I feel like their fate is in their hands right now.
That first goal from Jeremy Abobase was, great for him, but that was a great example when you're talking about RSL not tracking runs, of the defense just moving at a walking pace where, you know, the one player falls off and creates the opening for him to receive that.
Well, and there's I don't know if it's the center back or the right back, but they're standing fully behind him, watching him make the play. There's no attempt to get involved. And I get that, you know, he's beaten you already and he's open, but there's nobody there marking him. And then nobody really challenging him when he runs into the box either. If RSL does somehow manage to stay in sixth, I think that they're going to be a team that's pretty easily handled by any opponent, East or West, in the playoffs.
Sebastian Blanco, who had the two goals and the assist, his second was a real pretty first touch at an angle. I'd say it's probably my goal of the week.
Yeah, I mean, I really hate saying this as a Vancouver Whitecaps fan, but Sebastian Blanco's just fun to watch. I don't get tired of seeing him on the field. I don't like seeing him on the field if they're playing Vancouver. But his just sort of creative brilliance and quick-footedness is really, something to marvel at. And that goal is just such a weird, tight angle, and he is being closed down, but he just makes it look so easy.
Another one of these lopsided results is San Jose 1, New York Red Bulls 3. I looked at this as even though San Jose was at home, I was like, oh no, get out of there, San Jose. This isn't for you. And indeed,
it was not for them.
No. Bradley Wright Phillips' second goal stood out to me. New York first went up at 29 minutes with Alex Moyle scoring after Marcinkowski, the St. Jose keeper, tried to punch a shot away but just couldn't clear it. And then for that second, it really sort of solidifies matters. It's just another classic. The ball bounces free and Bradley Wright Phillips poaches.
Yeah, you really need to hang on to the ball as a goalkeeper if you've got Bradley Wright Phillips anywhere near you. And of course, Chris Wondolowski just has to cap things off and remind people that he is one of the best strikers in MLS history and just gets one in the 83rd minute. Just cause he can. But I have votes. I think we should start a new category, which is loneliest player in MLS. And I have three additions I'd like to make to it this week. Nick Raimondo.
Yep.
Tim Howard.
Yep.
And we were literally just talking about Wando. Chris Wondolowski.
Yeah.
Wando. Loneliest players in MLS. They're so good, but their teams are just not there for them.
The MLS Lonely Hearts Club. New York Red Bulls get this result, and to play the anything you could do game, Atlanta also won 2-1 against New England in a result that kind of shows why New England doesn't have a lot of rope left in terms of their playoff push, and just another very capably executed result for Atlanta, which was also sort of depth in scoring, as you have Bello and Gressel as the goal scorers.
Yeah, and this is the thing that really kind of scares me about Atlanta is the homegrown players that they're able to add. The fact that their academy system is already cranking out players. Great to see a 16-year-old come on and get his first MLS goal.
Yeah.
You've
always known that they must do with the players that they have.
Absolutely. Julian Gressel, who's been such a trooper for them over the season and provided so much, he gets his goal as well. The scary thing for Atlanta is, and I don't think it will matter all too much to them just because of how good they are, but is Almiron went out with a hamstring injury, and I believe that's been updated now that he's touch and go, but likely out for the remaining two games that Atlanta have.
I wouldn't use him in those games. Atlanta have qualified. If the supporter shield is important, but if they don't make the supporters shield, but they win MLS Cup because Almiron is playing.
Well, it seems like the story is now Almiron for sure won't be. He's out
for the season, or just for those
For those two games at least. They're saying that he's certainly not going to be ready for those two games.
I think that's I think that's fine.
I think so too. Which is not to take anything away. I think Almiron is by far the best creative midfielder in MLS right now. And has been so crucial for them. But, Atlanta has got themselves into this position through depth, not just the star performances. So if he's not available for any playoff games, that could matter. But as you said, they've clinched. Supporter Shield is great. I'm sure they'd love to win it. But if they don't and they can get Almiron back for the playoffs, I think they'll be just fine with that. I actually thought this was an okay performance from New England to put up a bit of a fight. They didn't make life easy for Atlanta. They got their chances. They were able to execute just too late, as we've seen with New England many times this season. Mm-hmm. But they looked a little bit more composed, organized, and disciplined. I don't see them. I know they're not mathematically eliminated from the playoffs. I don't see them making a late playoff push. And I think where they stand is where they kind of deserve to be. They've been just okay this season, but just not good enough.
Yeah, absolutely. I would say that Dallas 2, Orlando 0 is just sort of an encapsulation of both where both teams stand, a capable result for Dallas that came about as a result of two goals rifled in 3 minutes apart in the second half. This is the result that a team that is first in the East should get against the team that's last in the West. Or, sorry, first in the West should get against the team that's last in the East.
Yeah.
I didn't get a chance to see the LAFC game. What did you take away from that?
Here's my takeaway. Colorado's not a good team. And I feel real bad for Tim Howard. And that is about as much as I can say about Colorado at this point. I just feel so bad for their fans. They've given up. LAFC just walked all over them. And yeah, Colorado, similar to watching Houston play, there's just no marking anywhere on the pitch. And the fact that...
First goal literally scored by Walker Zimmerman.
Yeah.
So they did walk all over them.
Yeah. It was, it could have been much, much worse. but we're starting to see how Lee Wynn fits into LAFC's system and has done really well being this transition player for LAFC. Mm-hmm. Diego Rossi, I think, had like 4 or 5 shots. At least 2 or 3 of them should have gone in. So this could have been much worse, but LAFC clinches a playoff spot in their first year in MLS, so congrats to them. It'll be interesting to see how they can shake things up, a team that has been early in the season electric and then had a dip and has not been as exciting. And then, of course, they lost their captain and key center back. But I think they're going to be an interesting team in the playoffs that can just shake things up a little bit, because you never quite know which LAFC is going to turn up, but they've got 3 or 4 gears to them, multiple different ways that they can play. And for Colorado, here's the only thought I had about Colorado this week. I was like, didn't that guy for the Whitecaps that we had for a while get signed to them? Is he still there? What's his name? That's all I could think about with Colorado.
And who was it you were thinking of? I have this open.
Yeah, now I'm even forgetting his name.
Giles Barnes,
which I kind of liked him when he was here, but I think he has now played for every MLS club, including the ones that haven't even started in MLS yet, and just seems to be a non-entity. Colorado needs to make some kind of statement that they're ready to rebuild for next season, because right now it seems real doom and gloom for them.
No doubt. The big piece of MLS news this week outside of games is that San Jose, which has had such an unfortunate season, has made the signing of Chivas coach Matias Almeida.
Yeah.
Who is the one who indeed knocked off Toronto in the CONCACAF Champions League final. And his basically all the reaction that I've seen considers this a pretty big get for San Jose.
It is a big get for them. And a real, speaking of signals for intentions in the off season for clubs that have been eliminated, a great, great move for them. The slightly troubling thing is, and I don't know if this is just a report or if it's true, is that apparently in his contract, if he's offered the Mexico national team job, there's a release clause in his contract for it. So depending on how things shape up there, he could be only manager for a short time at San Jose. But
and yet, New York Red Bulls haven't been in the worst position working off of the system of a departed coach.
It's true. Hey, if he can come in for 6 months and rearrange things and bring in some good players and coach, he is apparently bringing his whole staff with him as well. So who knows how things will go there. But definitely a sign of intentions from San Jose to get back to where they were.
We know that the from some of the stories of Germany working with San Jose, that the system at San Jose, from a whole club direction, is sophisticated. So I'm interested to see what happens. Always when you look at a team, when you look at a successful coach coming in elsewhere to MLS, you wonder if they can truly navigate all of the weird TAM and GAM structures that exist in the league and all of the roster composition issues. But surely this is a star hire. And I guess a lot of people have been talking about Mark Dos Santos, and this isn't it.
Yeah, I don't get, maybe that's a thing to revisit another time, but I don't get the Mark Dos Santos hubbub about an untested MLS entity as being somehow something the Whitecaps should be bringing in. That somehow signals ambition, but whatever, we'll get to that if more ever comes of it.
Also happening this week is the CONCACAF Women's Championship, which is the qualifying for the FIFA Women's World Cup. There was a very capable match where they beat Jamaica 2-0, and then a big ol' match last night where they defeated Cuba 12-0.
Things did not go well for Cuba, I must say. Canada had 52 shots on net. Sorry, they had 52 shots, 25 shots on target.
Wow.
Cuba had one shot, zero on target. It is unfortunate sometimes when you see international soccer like this, where you just go, it's so disproportionate that it's not even fair. And it was great that Canada could remain locked in and consistent throughout this match, but as we saw with the Canadian men's national team recently, these results can sometimes belie where they're at because they just have room to roam. But what I was impressed with was to see Canada with a new coach stick to a system and play it for 90 minutes regardless of what the scoreline was, and look to play a very disciplined game rather than, you know, it did look like they were having fun. Clearly, there was not much in this game at any point. But they also played a lot of teenagers, and that was great to see, is that this is a slightly new-look Canada team, some players that we're probably not going to see playing on the first team a ton. Jordan Heidema amongst them with 4 goals, 17-year-old, had a fantastic game and showed that she's capable of scoring goals in lots of different ways. Christine Sinclair came ever so close to a landmark number of goals, and I'm forgetting the full number. I apologize, but she fell just short of that. But she did get a goal.
That's very good. I think the last one is that they'll be playing is Costa Rica. You have one of the best. I walked out of the room and I came back and indeed scored stories that I had ever heard related to this game. Could you share it with the audience?
Sure. Just to give a sense of how unmatched these teams were. I tuned in and it was 4-0, and then it was 5-0, and then the break for second half. So I thought, okay, this is my chance. I'm going to run out. I'm going to get some food and I'm going to come back and watch the second half. Came back and they had been playing the second half for, I believe, about 7 minutes, and it was 10-0. So, of course, it says a lot, too, about the curse I can have on teams, is that Canada scores 6 goals while I'm not watching, and then I come back and they only score 2. But, great for them, but I did have to wait, sort of be like, wait, what? No, what? That can't be right. I was like, how much of this match did I miss? I'm like, oh, we're only in like the 63rd minute or something. Okay. Well, it is 10-0 now.
That is on Thursday, the Canada-Costa Rica game that will wrap up matters.
Yeah.
I'm still looking for Christine Sinclair's goal total, but I'm just seeing that she's going to be in the contenders for the inaugural Women's Ballon d'Or, which I think is kind of like silly because there's been a Women's Player of the Year every year as part of the FIFA The Best competition. It's great to see these things reflected, but it's also important to note that the fractured nature of the awards is a soccer politics thing as much as it is anything else.
Yeah. Okay, I found the total, and I also just realized that we have the same birthday, which is fun. She has 174 goals now for Canada. And so she fell just one short of 175. That's the record she's looking for.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
She could do that. That's crazy to think about. It's so unfortunate that in a game like this, you know, you'd think this is an opportunity. Wouldn't it be only the slightest dampening of issues if Sinclair was able to surpass that milestone. But it's like, oh, by the way, it happened for Cuba.
But part of the reason why it didn't is because she can also play provider. She's a very creative player. I saw at least one assist she got to Heidema. So it's great to see her bringing the younger players in. And that needs to be the plan going forward. Of course, we want to see our captain, Christine Sinclair, get all the accolades and be recognized as the tremendous player that she is. But at 35 years old, she's not going to be playing forever. And she is focused on clearly bringing up the future of the Canadian women's national team, which is great. And she's not a selfish player. So I'm sure her eyes are set on that landmark and on the record. But she proved that game that she's still a very selfless player and willing to do whatever it takes for the team to win.
The record that she has to make, and it's, you know, it's a tough mark to cross. So there's no guarantee that it'll happen. Although it would be a wonderful, you know, bow to place on her career if she could make it. Is 184 goals scored by Abby Wambach.
Mm.
Where if she could just get to 185, so she's 10 goals away from tying.
Yeah.
I think it's kind of funny that I was having this thought a lot recently that, you know, watching Canada through those two Olympics and in all of the matches that they had against the United States, Abby Wambach was such a villain, but for Canadian fans. But I found myself trying to think of, like I found her name dropping off of my tongue recently. Like as I've been thinking, I was like, who was the big American star?
Yeah. Well, and there's years ago? And yeah, there's no denying what she does. I just think that, you know, she had a very aggressive style of play and was happy to play the villain, which is great and exciting. But I think there was a lot of on-field antics that got the ire of many a Canadian fan. That she seemed to always be able to get in the ear of the referee, and then all of a sudden things started to happen for U.S., but...
Of course, no disrespect for Abby. I think maybe that's just a sign of how many amazing players and personalities the Canadian women, or the U.S. women's national team has in its current configuration.
Yeah, and again, like, here's the thing. You gotta do what it takes. It's great to think that every player is gonna, you know, get up after every tackle and, you know, they're just going to put their head down and do the work and get the thing done. But there's a reason why she holds the world record for scoring the most goals for her national team. So, you know, at a certain point in soccer, you've got to go anyway, anyhow. Every player has their own style and you may not like it, but the goals speak for themselves.
You made a good point about the provider and there's a chance that I don't think anybody is going to doubt the contribution of Sinclair if she can't break that record, especially because at this time she is doing exactly what she needs to do to be able to, you know, contribute and work for the team as opposed to, you know, throw everything forward to try and break that individual milestone.
Without her, we wouldn't have players like Heidema. So,
no.
Regardless of what her career goals for Canada ends up being, she's fundamentally changed the sport in Canada for both men's and women's soccer. I mean, it's her efforts that have brought highlight to both national teams. So
yeah,
for that alone, she's always going to be a legend.
Absolutely. Where can we find you online?
You can find me online at That's So MLS on Twitter and on Instagram as well at That's So MLS, where I like to post some of the tasty plays of the week, if that's your thing. Where can we find you online?
You can find me online at Team Bates, www.team-bates.com. I am an editor for Howler Magazine. Issue 15 is coming out soon, whatahowler.com. And you can find this podcast at thatsomls.com. And on Apple Podcasts and wherever fine podcasts are located. please rate, review, and subscribe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And until next time, don't get sent off.